reincarnation, karma, and the divine. Next week, it will be the heart doctrine and human relationships. Now, on Wednesdays, we also get together from 7:30 to 8:45. We're currently studying the Ocean of Theosophy, and we're in Chapter 2. Then, of course, on Fridays, we have a roundtable, a less formal roundtable meeting from 5:15 to 7:15. Everyone is welcome to come. The 2 hours is not fixed in stone. It depends on the flavor of the meeting, and sometimes it goes in different directions. But we start off with having, as a common basis, you know, a different article each week from the High Life, from B.P. Wadia, and which is a book, a series of articles. We're trying to remember the article for this coming week.
Lust for Power?
Lust for Power is the article in Living the High Life by B.P. Wadia. So that's 5:15 to 7:15 on Friday. The ULT is supported entirely by voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. All are welcome to attend. There's no limitation on that. It's always free to attend for all people. Now, contributions of time, service, and money are certainly invited and gratefully received, but there is no obligation there's no obligation imposed on anyone or implied along those lines. So with that, our topic for today is reincarnation, karma, and the divine. And this will be carried on in the form of a panel discussion with two of the associates, and then the rest of the hour will be for questions and discussion. So we're approaching it by way of discussing karma and reincarnation as intellectual doctrines themselves, and then applied in life with a sense and an understanding of the divine purpose behind them. So when we consider reincarnation and karma, we're talking from the perspective of new folks who come to the lodge. Ideally, we like to think that people who come to Theosophy Hall have, of course, a deep yearning for spiritual answers to the unanswerable questions of life. We'd all like to believe that they all walk through the door for the first time in pursuit of how to further the cause of universal brotherhood. But for some of the folks, it's just not the case. They're interested, they've heard of it. A lot of them come through the door already with those ideas in mind, who've already caught the flavor and the spirit of the movement, but don't even know what it's called. And then when they come to the lodge, they recognize, wow, this is where I've been all my life. So it can be said, nevertheless, with some level of truth, that there are those who come to the lodge for the first time for their own personal reasons. They have their own language, they have their own questions, they have their own personal framework of thought that they are kind of comparing and contrasting, and very often they don't realize, as is the case with much of the world, that those questions, that language, and those ways of thinking aren't their own. They're what have been put into their brains by their school, by the TV that they watch, and by other things that they allow in. And this can happen because of perhaps there's not yet enough focus on their own inner life as the source of answers to their questions. So for such people, in their own view, from their own viewpoint, when they come to the lodge and find some level of interest in Theosophy, they may approach Theosophy as an intellectual pursuit. It can seem to take on sometimes, the teachings of Theosophy could seem from a strictly intellectual perspective to take on rather a mechanistic view or a mechanistic cue. After all, the doctrines of the ancient wisdom and for the purposes of this talk, the doctrines of karma and reincarnation are logical. They are reasonable to understand. And so when folks come and learn about it and compare it to their corresponding teachings from other religions, such as vicarious atonement, or the idea of heaven and hell, or the idea of being reincarnating again as an animal rather than a human being as a result of your karma, compared with the teachings of theosophy, theosophy can seem to be reasonable and intellectually more valid. And so it might be accepted on that basis. So there's nothing wrong with trying to learn these doctrines intellectually. There are some who come here because in their own understanding, they just feel it, they find it very interesting, or they're in pursuit of answers that fit their own framework. But some who come even they've learned something about esoteric secrets, and they might have heard about names or whatever associated with the theosophical movement, and they're here for the secrets. But of course, while the intellectual study of theosophy is important and it's necessary to understand it, either immediately for some or gradually for others, it needs to be tempered with a sense of the divine value of these ideas. It needs to be tempered, and that's going to be the second half of this presentation. The teachings which descend to us, the intellectual study of which is as deep as any human mind can go, these teachings have power in and of themselves because they are true teachings. If the power of theosophical ideas is brought to life on strictly an intellectual basis, it can be dangerous. It can be used as a destructive force, and it has indeed been used as a destructive force. How so? Well, let's just take a look at a couple of basic examples of a cold intellectual application of the ideas of karma. For instance, I'm doing this today because I've learned about karma, and I know if I do this, then under law, that has to come to me. This is dangerous. Karma will have to bring that to me, and it's spiritual. It's taught in theosophy. Or another misunderstanding is, such and such happened to my next door neighbor's family. I wonder what they did in their past life to end up deserving that. Sure, I'm sure glad it's not me. Or even, I know I inherited my wealth. Really, I didn't work for it, but obviously my soul is a good soul, or I wouldn't have been graced like this, and now I can live on cruise ships for the rest of my life. So these ideas can also be, as we all know, applied to justifying the execution of criminals, and on and on. The misunderstanding of karma because of over-intellectualizing can lead to one rationalizing that he personally is the agent of karma, and a person who misunderstands that they are an agent of karma can decide to execute this understanding of karma, the misunderstanding, when and where he wants, and really believing that his opinion or his desires is really what karma is all about. Now, on the other hand, let's look at reincarnation. Some of the intellectual conclusions that can be brought from misunderstanding reincarnation would be such as, everything makes more sense when you know about reincarnation. In my previous life, when I was Napoleon Bonaparte, I learned this. Therefore, I'm the authority on it because I've got so much wisdom from my previous lives. Or things like, if you do such and such, you'll come back as an animal so you can burn off your karma. Or even in this life, I don't like such and such about myself, so I just have to deal with it. There's nothing I can do about it, but because I suffer that much in this life, in my next life, it'll be the opposite because I deserve it karmically and I'll get it through reincarnation. Mr. Judge talks about how our philosophy theosophical philosophy of life is one grand whole. Everything has to fit physically and metaphysically and ethically. Its ethical application must proceed similarly. If it's in conflict with someone's old opinions, those opinions must be discarded in order to appreciate the value of what the teachings, the theosophical teachings, can be. And there are certain internal changes that need to be made. So that he kept in mind. The next panelist will talk about rather than the personal intellectualizing of karma and reincarnation, we're going to see it more from an impersonal with use of the divine ideas that they truly are.
This talk will answer three questions for us. What is the theosophical doctrine of reincarnation of karma? What is the relationship between reincarnation karma and the divine? And finally, if reincarnation and karma and the divine have a relationship, are reincarnation and karma merciful and just if they are divine laws of life? So let's begin with the first question. What is the theosophical doctrine of reincarnation? Basically, it comes down to the understanding that they are two aspects of one law. And that law is the law of periodicity. Now, we say it has two aspects because we can see this law operating in all departments of nature in one of two ways. We can see as it operating as cycles in the periodic repetition of events. And we can also see it operating as the periodical or cyclical return of every impression to the point of its origin. That's the law. Now, we can study that law in the method of science by going from particulars to universals. So we see in every department of nature, return of impressions, repetition of events, re-embodiment, action, reaction, cause and effect. And we can also see those same laws operating in the physical, emotional, mental, moral, and spiritual experience of every human being. So as scientists, we can gather all those particulars and come to a general conclusion that reincarnation and karma are laws of life because they are in themselves cyclical and based on cause and effect. Now, we can also study this from universals to particulars, which is the method of philosophy. Remembering, theosophy is a religious, scientific, and philosophical. So going from universals to particulars, we can start with the proposition that periodicity, re-embodiment, cause and effect, is a universal principle that applies to every individual immortal human soul. The experience then of every soul is a countless series of incarnations in a mortal body that are different and temporary. Different bodies, different personalities that are mortal and temporary. And also that the conditions, the experiences, the qualities of each body are the result and reaction of previous causes and actions of that individual soul, either in this life or a previous one. So that's if we go from universals to particulars. And in doing this, we come up with three key features of a law of re-embodiment and karma, or action and reaction. One is that these laws are universal. They apply to all beings. The second conclusion we come to is that this law, these laws, operate impartially. In other words, they unerringly operate on all beings without favoritism or malice. The law doesn't decide, I'm going to do a particular favor for you, and I'm going to be particularly against you. It's not capricious in that way. And also, its impersonality. Its operation is not directed by a single supreme divine being. It is, in fact, independent of all beings, and yet all beings experience it, and it works through all beings that are manifested. So it takes a manifested being to experience it, but a manifested being of whatever degree, no supreme being, directs it or controls it. It's an impersonal, universal law of nature. So having answered the question of what theosophy teaches about reincarnation and karma, let's look at the relationship between reincarnation, karma, and the divine. So, but we first have to consider, what does theosophy mean by the divine? So theosophy puts forth this proposition that deity is one universal, unmanifested, undifferentiated, eternal, and absolute. Now, what does that word absolute mean? It means that deity is not conditioned or definable. It is beyond conditions or definition. It is infinite. That means it is nowhere. You can't say deity dwells here. And it is everywhere. Same time. It is eternal. It has no beginning. It has no ending. And here's an interesting thing, sometimes a stumbling block. It is changeless. And what that means is that it cannot directly influence or interact with any manifested being. Because if it did, it would cease to be changeless. In order to interact and to have a relationship, there has to be change. So it's changeless. And yet, it's ceaseless in its abstract, inherent motion, because periodically we see that abstract inherent motion manifest, which can only be described as a great breath, an outbreathing and an inbreathing, or day and night. And when we have the outbreathing, the day, the entire universe of solar system, worlds, beings, comes forth into manifestation from the unknown darkness. And when we have the night or the inbreathing, that entire manifestation returns into the one. So there's this ceaseless end, beginning and ending, of universes and solar systems without any beginning or ending. So there has to be, within that deific principle, ceaseless motion. And yet, it is not changed by whatever manifests or influenced by it. Something to think about. So it cannot be a being, because whatever being we imagine in our mind has some kind of limitation, some kind of relationship. some type of limitation in space, if not time. So we might say it is Venus, the one eternal unmanifested reality behind whatever manifested being there is. We call it Venus because it is the unmanifested reality behind all beings that manifested. So what then we might say is, why is it called a divine principle, a deific principle? Because it is universal in one, it's impersonal, it's impartial, meaning it's absolute. That's it's why we say it's a divine deific principle. It's beginning to sound a lot like karma and reincarnation. Interesting. Because they, we have said, are universal, impartial, impersonal. So what does this mean? It means that they are divine laws of life. Reincarnation and karma inherently, in their divine essence, are one with deity. They share the same quality, if you wanted to put it, divine quality. And when they manifest, when they become observable, we see that they still maintain that divine quality. They are impersonal, they are impartial, and they are universal. So we call them divine principles. Now, those that believe in a supreme being, one of the attributes they give to the supreme being, besides it being all-knowing and all-powerful, is it's all-merciful, all-compassionate, all-loving, and all-just. So we can ask, is karma and reincarnation merciful and just if they are divine laws of life? So karma has been described as the law of laws, because in its operation, it is universal harmony and equilibrium, which is actually on the observable plane of manifestation, the expression of that unknown, omnipresent, unobservable unity and oneness of all, which is the deific principle. It's the manifestation. Harmony is the manifestation of oneness. And it operates to restore, we see it operating to restore balance and harmony wherever it is disturbed. And so karma and reincarnation, we're going to talk about karma first. Karma is just and merciful, and for three reasons. It compensates the actions of every human being who creates, preserves, and restores that equilibrium, who works with the law. Now, we in our human minds say it rewards, but it does not actually reward. It reacts, it adjusts. If you work with that universal harmony, it responds in a way that benefits the one who is the servant of it. You are a co-worker with nature. So it is just. And it compensates for the experiences we might have of the actions of others who, in their error, have thrown our lives into disharmony, dis-ease, pain, and suffering. So we all know that we suffer and experience pain at the hands of others' actions. And it throws us into discord, disharmony, disease. And so there is that universal law that compensates the individual who precedes that and gives them the opportunity to balance that out, to experience in some way the influence that will bring their inner nature into accord and balance again. So it is merciful. But it is also merciful to the perpetrator, the one who has caused that suffering and that harm to others, because it adjusts those actions that produce disharmony by bringing that disturbance back to the being who was the original of the disturbance. And while that adjustment may be experienced or perceived as the perpetrator, as punishment or suffering, it is in fact merciful. It is unerring in that it brings to the perpetrator, the one who set up the disturbance, in direct proportion to the suffering that one has caused others. So we learn what we have done to others by experiencing that pain and disturbance in our own lives at some point. We get to know what it feels like, because in our original action, we had no idea that we were doing it. We may not have meant it, we may have consciously done it, but we did something to upset the balance, and so we need the lesson. So it is the merciful teacher that gives the perpetrator of the action the opportunity again and again until the lesson is learned. And that's the point. That's what makes it just and merciful. It's not you have to learn this now or you're never going to learn it. It gives it to us again and again until the individual begins to act in harmony with the divine law of life from which they had deviated. And reincarnation is the doctrine of hope based on that divine justice and mercy, as it provides countless experiences and opportunities under law for the continued progress, learning, and readjustment of every being in their march towards unification in wisdom and action, knowledge and action toward the divine. So through this law of reincarnation or re-embodiment, no one, no thing, and no being is left out. No being or thing is left behind, and no one or being is left to eternal suffering. So this is truly a divine law of compassion and mercy. Now, having presented that, now we'll leave you the opportunity to ask questions or make comments on both these presentations.
MDW, please unmute.
From listening to our presentations this morning, we are very struck by the idea that we should be happy, we should be hopeful. You know, that everything that is coming to us, we've really had a hand in making in some way, shape, or form. So whatever comes to us is a blessing.
And isn't the quality of the experience when we experience the return of impressions really so much a matter of our attitude toward it? MHW?
So how do you answer somebody who says, well, it's all fate. There's nothing I can do to change their what is my lot? No matter what I do, you know, if this is something that I've earned, there's nothing I can do about it then. It's fate.
We've heard that question before, and we're pretty quick to agree with them. It definitely is fate in some respects. If you put your hand in the fire, you are fated to get burned, but you put the hand in the fire. Now, of course, typically there's, you know, more of a gap between the cause and the effect. And there's a lot of different ways we can learn our lessons. When the effect is coming back, step one is you know, if we take the attitude of ownership and personal responsibility, then that is empowerment. That gives us our own power to approach it in a different way than to presume that I'm the victim of something. So that's one way. Perhaps step one is to just own it. Anyone else?
We would ask the person what they mean by fate before trying to answer the question. And if they said, well, something's fate if there's no control over it, or it's out of my control, then it's fate. So I would follow up with, or we could follow up with, well, suppose you did something good. Suppose you helped someone, or you did something beneficial. And you did the same thing as another person. Both people do the same thing. One person gets rewarded for it. Another person doesn't get rewarded. One person gets rewarded way in proportion to the activity. The other person gets rewarded, but not quite up to the same level. Yet they both did it with the same intention, the same wisdom, the same knowledge. Then you could truly say it's fate, because it was either decided by some being who had it personally wished that that person would be rewarded in greater proportion to me or less proportion to me, and it's out of my hands. I can't control it because it's controlled by this other being. Or it's completely due to chance. We did the same thing, and it just so happens that that person got more than I did. That's fate, because it's out of your control. So that's what fate means. So reincarnation and karma especially, cannot be fatalistic, because it is determined by law. It is in your control. It is impartial, unerring, and in proportion to the causes set up. And if you do the same thing as another person does, you're going to get the same goal. You're going to reach the same end.
CBW.
JD. Hold on, CBW. JD.
I was going to say, it's been my experience, or at least my point of view, that the universe does throw random problems into our lap to see what we'll do with it as a learning opportunity. Now, you can say, yes, this is a effect of a cause, something in a past life. But if I don't know what the cause is, for all practical purposes, it's a random event. I have no way of knowing what caused this event. So I treat it as a random event, an opportunity to a challenge to grow spiritually, to solve this problem, whatever the solution is.
Well, certainly, from the personal level, so much that goes on. We personally have no way of knowing. We don't know where so much of this comes from. But from an impersonal level, if we look at life from the perspective of everything comes to me under law, then it puts us in a place where all of us are anyway, whether we know where it comes from or not. So just to put it in perspective, a psychologist we've read has really made strides with an individual, whether they believe in reincarnation and karma or not. But he's really made strides with an individual who has a lot of personal issues when they stop blaming other people, when they can't go deep enough to back in the source of their early life, when they don't know what the karma is. But when the individual finally takes that step and is willing to accept responsibility anyway, even though he doesn't know the cause, that's a big step toward healing. That's what we've heard. Anyone else?
We would like to respond to that, because it's a feeling or a thought that we've all had. And that is, can we define something as random because we don't know the cause? And we would say that randomness is exactly the opposite. When we know the cause, and it doesn't happen the way we know it should under law, that's randomness. Not the ignorance of something doesn't make it real. We don't know how our bodies operate, but thank goodness it's not random. If we knew how the body operates and we woke up one morning and we had three arms or no head or two brains or six eyes, that would be truly random. So we don't think it's fair for us to judge the occurrence in our lives of things we don't know the cause of as being random.
LG had her hand up. Hold on. Who?
CBW has been waiting.
Okay, yes. CBW, thank you.
Yeah, I was thinking of the term individuality. And when one begins to think of that undivided, the next step is harmony, balance. So therefore, if we always use the term individuality or undivided self first, then any deviation from that in any department of nature, nature restores that harmony. And when we learn to cooperate with that individuality, then that's a step forward. So in these situations, we have to simplify. And so we begin with that word, individuality. That's my contribution.
Thank you. LG had her hand up. LG, no?
Well, in thinking of when we think of ourselves not as personalities, but we think of ourselves as divine pilgrims, no matter what conditions under karma come to us, we always do have, there is no fate in that, because we always have a choice. Our choice is in our attitude. Our choices in planting better seeds for the future, our choices in helping others. Because no matter how powerless we are to the forces of karma, we always have the power to help others. The power, as was mentioned earlier, of happiness. That is what we can do. And one question though for the speaker, when talking about the absolute has no relationship. And I was wondering, does that, what is meant in the Gita when it says, Krishna says, I am in them, but they are not in me?
Yes. I am in them, meaning that divine principle is the basis of all things. Nothing could exist unless it came from some source. But to say that one thing is in or out of that eternal absolute is placing it in relationship to it. So we could say that, can we say that an object is in space? To say such would be that it could possible for it to be out of space. And it can't be. And yet space is in through everything. We did want to follow up on that contribution of ourselves as divine beings. How do we know that we are essentially divine beings? Well, we've attempted to describe what the word divine means. For something to be divine, whether it's a principle, whether it's a law, it has to be universal, it has to be impartial, and it has to be impersonal. That's the quality of divinity. Is there something in us that's universal, that's everywhere? Wherever we are, in what condition, it's present. Is there something in us that's impersonal, impartial? It cannot be defined by personal attributes. It's not favorable or unfavorable us. It just is. And if we look within ourselves, we see that there is something in ourselves. It is, in fact, our essential nature, whether we call it ourselves, the power to observe, the thinker, the observer, which is always there, the same in all experiences. Not only that, we recognize in talking with other human beings that they have that same awareness of that impersonal principle, impartial principle. And whether they perceive or we perceive them as being different from us in some quality, whether we perceive or they perceive themselves as being good people or bad people, it's still the same principle there. So there is a divine part of our nature that is divine and present in every human being. And that's our fundamental basis. That's the basis of our universal brotherhood. We are one in our spiritual divine essence, and we sooner or later learn to treat ourselves and one another that way.
MDW, you've had your hand up. I mean, no, excuse us, NHW, thank you.
In regards to the random question, we just wanted to say that it doesn't matter if we know what is happening to us. It's not important that we know the reason from a previous life. And the philosophy actually says that at this point in time in our evolution, we wouldn't want to know what we've done. It's something that we may not be able to handle. So when our duty comes to us, when through karma, that is how our lessons are going to be learned. When we function with a good motive in order to do that duty that comes to us. And when one really looks at it, it doesn't matter if we know why this specific duty is coming to us, you know, our karma is happening to us. It's just our reaction to it that it's almost like cheating. If we know the answers ahead of time for a test and we take the test and we do well, we're not really learning anything. But if we don't know those answers, then, and we do well on the test, then that is a good thing. So it's the same with not knowing why things are happening to us. And we want to say that there's a chat from ZZ with a question.
Let's respond to that question. So if we were a circus performer and our specialty was walking the high wire, 100 feet above the ground, and all that kept coming to our mind was the 99 times we tripped or fell on the wire and landed in the safety net. That's all we could get out of our mind. How confident will we be in walking across that wire? How easy would it be without the net during the performance with thousands of people watching? It would be distraction. And you can think of many examples. The person getting ready for a performance or getting ready for a test. If all you can think is the flubbing and the mistakes, if all that's crowding into your mind, it's very difficult to do what needs to be done. So one of the just and merciful aspects of karma is, as was pointed out, we don't yet have the ability to remember because we're not that trained, we're not that strong. We don't have the chance or opportunity to remember the details of all our past failures that brought us to the condition. It's not like we have a clean slate, we have the experiences of that, but we're not flooded with the memory of that. And so we are free to the best of our ability to act differently, knowing that we must have had something to do with it, but we also have the opportunity to change it. So we just wanted to add that. And then ZZ's question, if another's erroneous action is also the fulfillment of justice, how could there be subsequent mercy? So let's give an example of that. We suffer at the hands of another. And the suffering they caused us is erroneous, and they will have to experience the karma of that. In the meantime, because we do not remember what brought us to that condition, to experience that suffering, to experience the harm and hurt that we caused others from another human being, because we don't know that, it seems to us that that's unjust, unfair. What did I do? I'm the victim here. And so because of that disease, that disharmony, that questioning, that imbalance that's in ourselves that throws us off our moral sense of justice and right, there is an opportunity under karma to experience a benefit and reward. Now, that may or may not occur in one's life. One may not experience it until another life. But we are told, and we can study this at another time, that in the states after death, particularly in that state of Devakan, the soul experiences the rest, the readjustment, the benefit, the reward, if you will, as compensation of every suffering they experienced in life that they thought was unfair. Because in that state, there is no contrast. By its divine nature, one can only experience pleasure and benefit and good without the perception of evil, hurt, or pain. It's a purely subjective state of reward. So the person in that state receives the benefit of it in proportion to the degree of suffering, unfair, or otherwise they experienced in this life. So that's a merciful action in karma because it operates after death and during our physical lives, because it's all one life. It's just the experience of the soul in different planes of being.
LG?
Well, two things come to mind. And one is the idea of the importance of forgiveness in regards to what was just said. And the other is that karma can be seen as merciful because it puts us in a position where we're never really the victim, but that we always, it gives us more power. It puts us in the driver's seat rather than being a victim to everything. It would be awful to have to reincarnate over and over and over again and be constantly a victim to the forces of other people and other beings. So there seems to be a mercy in the fact that we are the ones in control of karma and in what we in what we say and do? And again, what is the power of forgiveness that's required in order for us to understand this idea of victimhood and its application with karma?
So what is the basis for forgiveness? You know, why is that the healthy position to take? Perhaps step one is realizing that although a lot of people will ask forgiveness, it's the one who's doing the forgiving who really benefits from the forgiveness. It's not the one who's being forgiven, unless a sentence is being waived or something. Okay, can we mute? Okay. So, forgiveness in that sense is a release, is you're not attached to whatever that situation was. It's just seeing it from an impersonal distance. And forgiveness is more beneficial to the forgiver. That's our thought. So,
if we may add to that, please, also based on a chat contribution, forgiveness release the victim and the abuser is a release of karma. And this, behind this question, there's that doctrine or that theological doctrine that we can be forgiven for our sins and released from the consequences of our sins by another human being. When we forgive another, as was just pointed out, by not holding on to the hurt, brooding it, by not biting back, by not hitting back, retaliating, what we've done that there is not added to the increased karma of the situation. And we've helped the other person as well. Because if we had acted that way, very likely they would have retaliated back to us and added to their karma. And also, when we retaliate, we add to their suffering, which they don't see that they deserve. And so karma will compensate them for that at some point. So when we forgive another person, we don't release the karma. If they've done the action, by forgiving them, we've not added to the problem. And we set up causes for better things in the future for both. But we cannot erase the karma. The situation will go on for both until the lesson is learned and both individuals learn the causes which put them into this situation, either as the experiencer or the perpetrator of the harm, and begin to change. And maybe they'll change so much that little debt, that little interaction they had in one life, that little benefit to learn can become the foundation in some life for a great relationship and friendship, of the soul's recognition that through that experience, one has grown better. And don't we see that in life? That sometimes the people in high school that seem to be our opponents and enemies, as we mature later on and they mature, they can become the closest of our friends, because we can look back and laugh at the ways we were and what we've learned in the meantime and use it as a foundation to get closer and compensate for that. And so what happens in one life can go on through many, many lives. Well, we're coming up to the end here. We wanted to remind you that next Sunday, continuing on this theme of general theosophical principles, we have a very interesting presentation on the heart doctrine and relationships in everyday life, interpersonal relationships, which really takes this idea of karma and reincarnation and makes it even more practical as we understand that law in how we conduct ourselves in everyday life. So thank you for your participation and contribution today, and we certainly welcome you back to next week's meeting and also our Wednesday evening and Friday evening classes and discussions. At this point, we'll close our meeting.